Live from Washington, D.C., this is Warbird Radio.
Log on now to FightingColors.com. That's FightingColors.com for more on Gary Velasco and his amazing nose art. That's FightingColors.com.
Hi, I'm Chris.
And I'm Rob.
And we're two of the crew members from Warbird Rescue. Call in Thursday nights at 8 Eastern to join the lively discussion of Warbird restoration. Find out how we can put you in touch with a Warbird project in your area. And be sure to visit us online at warbirdrescue.com.
That's warbirdrescue.com.
And we'll talk to you Thursdays at 8 right here on Warbird Radio.
Now showing on aerocinema.com.
1944. The English Channel is all that stands between a massive land invasion into Hitler's Europe. The Allies are poised and ready to make the crossing, and the Nazis are desperate to repel them. Using new technology and innovative concepts, the Luftwaffe will summon forth a dive bomber unique in looks and abilities. This will be their shield to defend against the flood of ships bound for German territory. A Pair of Hunchbacks, Part 1.
What a kick to be part of Warbird Radio with Big Band Jump, heard several times each week. I'm Don Kennedy, host of BBJ, inviting you to tune in, take off with Warbird Radio.
Live from the land of the free, because of the brave, this is Warbird Radio.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Wix Warbird Weekly Live here with you on Warbird Radio. It is Wednesday, like it always is, March the 2nd, and we are joining you again live here from the Warbird Radio studios spread halfway across the country. I'm your host, Ryan Keough, and joining me, as he always is our friend from deep in the heart of Texas, Zane Adams, moderator on the Wix Internet forums at warbirdinformationexchange.org. Zane, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing well, doing well. Happy Texas Independence Day to everybody out there.
Yeehaw!
175 years ago today, we did what all free men should do. So, you know, it was it's a state holiday here. Of course, I don't work for the state, so I had to work today. But
understandable. That's understandable. Well, yeah. Welcome everyone on board, and welcome all those Texans that are listening, and everybody else from across the country who are interested in Warbirds tonight. And we actually have a special guest this evening, and wanted to bring him on board. He's joining us from Stockton, California, Wix member and Warbird restoration expert, and the owner of Vintage Aircraft in Stockton, California, specializing in Twin Beach restorations, Ty Ramey. Ty, welcome aboard. Thank you for joining us here on Wix Warbird Weekly Live.
Thank you very much, guys. It's an honor to be here.
Well, you've certainly been very, very active on the forum, and we were dying to get you on board. So certainly it's an honor to have you on here, and you've certainly contributed a lot of information to the forum over the last couple of years, I should say, because you've been active with us for a while. You're a relatively young person for the Warbird community, and have been active in restorations for so long, and really have done a wide variety of adventures, I guess you could say, in your time working with Warbirds. How did you get started with the Warbird bug, you know, way back when?
Oh yeah, it's probably like a lot of you guys. My influence was my father. He flew in World War II, got in right at the tail end. He was a navigator in B-29s out of Saipan, and flew two missions right before the war ended. So, you know, I grew up with my dad building model airplanes and flying, you know, model airplanes and all of that kind of stuff, and just, you know, always had a real love and interest for World War II. You know, I just played World War II with my buddies as a kid, and it just kind of grew from there. Was collecting instruments that would get at a garage sale, or I remember bringing a bomb home from a flea market, sticking out the side window of a Volkswagen Bug. Be interesting to try and get away with that nowadays. But, you know, just playing with the stuff and having fun with it, and it just kind of slowly grew into a business, I guess. My dad, when I was a freshman in college, my dad got me a gun turret. that he had bought out of a publication called Shotgun News. And this gun turret was in a crate, and new old stock in a crate. It had the plexiglass dome on it and a canvas cover over it, and it was out on the driveway Christmas morning, and it was just, you know, that's the ultimate Christmas gift, to get your own gun turret. it was pretty cool. Everybody should have one.
Sure.
This cover on top of the turret said turret training type 8-8 for model AT-11 aircraft, and I'm like, wow, that's cool, Dad, but what the heck is an AT-11? And he says, oh, I used to fly one of those out in Saipan. My buddy of mine and I took one, and we buzzed the Japanese island of held island of Rota and made the controllers, you know, the Japanese controllers jump out of the tower. And I thought, wow, that's quite the story, Dad. And kind of wondered if that was true. But anyway, he showed me a picture of this, what the AT-11 was. And I thought, well, that's really cool. Now I need to find an airplane to go with my gun turret. So that's kind of what started the whole Twin Beach thing.
Wow.
AT-11, of course, is a Bombardier trainer version of the Twin Beach. And I was going to school at San Jose State, and I went back to school there right after Christmas, and they had two Beach 18s in the back, and I was, you know, went and sat in one of those Twin Beaches, and was just kind of hanger flying, spitting on the windshield glass, thinking, God, I'm going to own one of these someday. And lo and behold, the other beach in front of me had a circle rivet on top of the fuselage, like where the turret would go. And it had this round nose on it, and not the glass nose, but I went over there and looked in under the floorboards there, the mounting plate for the turret, and I was pretty excited. And thinking that, wow, this is a real AT-11, or at least it used to be. Went in and talked to the department chairman right there, and he says, yeah, as a matter of fact, we just decided to get rid of those airplanes. But that's a lot of airplane for a, you know, first project for a freshman. Are you sure you know what you're getting into? And I said, no, I have no idea what I'm getting into, but I really want this airplane. And the chairman says, well, okay, but it's not being sold with the engines, but you can have it for $250.
Oh, my goodness.
All right.
And what year was this again when they sold it to you?
I think this is 82.
That's still not very long ago. I mean, wow.
No, it wasn't too long ago at all. And so I bought the airplane, and still had to borrow the money from my mom to get it, and I ended up having to pay like $1,200 to move it. But that's kind of what started the whole Twin Beach thing. I got this airplane and started learning about them, and learned as much as I could to get that thirst for knowledge going, and started collecting books and manuals and more information, and, you know, looking for a more original AT-11. It just kind of snowballed from there.
Wow.
So that's a long-winded answer to your question.
Well, you know, no one has a simple route, I guess you could say, to get to Warbirds and such. So, I mean, yeah. But it sounds oh, go ahead.
You still have that AT-11? Is that
one that's... I sold that a while back. Worked on it for quite a while, and then I was always looking for, you know, a more original AT-11, because this thing had been modified heavily and was turned into a little airliner. And I was looking at an original one that was up in Alaska, and at the time there was one came up and traded a plane, an SMB-1, the Navy version, you know, out in Michigan. And I went out and looked at that, so, oh, this is a pretty decent airplane, decided to buy it. The guys out there, those old Yankee Air Force folks up in Saginaw, and they asked, well, how are you going to get this thing home? I said, well, I'm going to fly it home. And they looked at me like I'm, you know, off my rocker, which I probably was. And they went home, built up all the engines and parts and tools, and we went out and fixed that thing up and flew it home. That's, I guess, another story in itself. But the beaches are pretty neat. So I ended up selling that one beach, and then that's kind of what started the business. So I was at this point, a crossroads in my life, where I was going to go off and do the airline thing, or, you know, try and go after doing a Beach 18 business. And all my buddies that went off to do the airline thing seemed to bitterly complain about it. So I guess I did the right thing, but it's grass is always greener, so who knows? But it's been a lot of fun anyway.
I gotta say, one thing I gotta ask is, you know, I know that you had an experience kind of early on that, you know, many of us would kill for, which was the opportunity to recover the B-29 out of, or help recover the B-29 out of China Lake, and bring it overseas to Duxford. If you could fill us in a little bit on that, on the details to that, and kind of what was what, you know, your experience was with that. That's something I've always been just absolutely fascinated with.
Yeah, that was really a trip of a lifetime too. That was pretty neat. To back up a little bit, when I was in high school, I used to volunteer down at the Team Air Museum, and I'd go down there during the summers in high school and live with Lois Work. She used to run the little gift shop in the tin shack up front, and And I'd stay with her and then come out every day and volunteer and work on the airplanes. And one of the planes that I was in love with, of course, because my dad was a B-29. And so every chance I got to work on that thing, I did, and was putting that back together. Well, the gentleman who was director of restoration at the time, Bob Johnson, had met the chief engineer that had come over from Duxford, who was looking at getting one of these B-29s out of China Lake. And Bob Johnson told him about this, kid and his dad, who were real B-29 nuts. And we ended up getting in touch with Jeff Bottomley, and just struck it off real well. Well, my dad had connections at Hughes, and my dad arranged for Jeff Bottomley and myself and a couple of friends to go down to Long Beach and actually get to see the Spruce Goose when she was still locked up, under lock and key. Yeah, and the hangar down at Long Beach in the harbor. And, oh, my God, it was just incredible to see that thing in her own hangar there. We got the tour from this gentleman who was with the airplane, all through its building it and its flight, and he's been in charge of it ever since. And it was just incredible. We got to crawl through it, sit in the seat and crawl all the way through the wings and up in the tail, and it was just amazing. Well, as a result, Jeff Bottomley was so... happy to have been able to have that opportunity that he offered for my dad and I to be able to fly on the B-29 out of China Lake, actually from Tucson. It was in Tucson by this time, to fly on the airplane as part of the crew. Although Jeff said that I really don't recommend that you go past the East Coast of the United States because I'm not really sure it's going to make it. He didn't want to have to deal with my mom if her husband and son were lost, in the North Atlantic and in February of 1980. So, but it was really cool that he gave us that opportunity. And we went down to Tucson and met Jack Kern, who is in charge of aero services, a guy who's contracted to get the B-29 flying and to bring it over there and meet the pilot, Skip Cadier. And the first time we walked into the office, Skip was saying, asking Jack, so where's my navigator? And my dad, who was a B-29 navigator, he said, well, I'll do that for you if you want. And he thought he was kidding. He said, well, do you have a sextant? And my dad said, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. He said, oh. So my dad became the official navigator on the crew, and I was just official dead weight pretty much. But what was really neat is when we got to go on that trip is my dad used his original A10A sextant, his Astro Compass. The only modern tool he had was a old HP 65 programmable calculator with little magnetic cards, and he had an aviation pack in there with all the, the star charts and data to help him out. But he navigated that thing, especially when we got past, started heading up towards, up to Greenland and Iceland. We didn't really have anything navigation wise. Had a FlexGate compass system, original system, and then we had a, HF radio that didn't work so good, and of course VR didn't work. So my dad actually did what he did in World War II, and it was the neatest thing to be able to see that. And I got to help him by taking sun shots and moon shots up in the Astrodome. I consider my dad the last true B-29 navigator because he got that plane. He got that plane over to Greenland and then to Iceland. When we had no radios, we had pretty much an in-flight emergency, and you had no heat in the airplane, and it was freezing cold, and it was a miserable trip. My dad, did a hell of a job getting us there. And I remember when we landed in Greenland, it was about 30 below zero. It was miserable, and my dad and I were the last ones out of the airplane with Skip Cadier, and Skip turned to my dad and says, "You're one hell of a tough old World War II navigator." And, my dad had a little twinkle in his eye. I think that was one of the best compliments he ever got.
Wow.
It was really an incredible trip. It really was.
A lot of that's a lost skill, and it's amazing that people still know how to do that or still can do it. And I guess you've basically almost got to be Air Force trained to be able to do it. I don't know who else around can take sextant and navigate like that. It is an amazing skill. That sounds like a heck of a trip. I guess B-29s are in your blood because you've got a little piece of or a few B-29 pieces floating around your shop out there in California. You got that Hollywood B-29 nose, I guess. You still got that?
Yeah. We did, but it's gone now. Actually, there's a guy that wanted it a whole lot worse than I did. I hate to say it because the B-29 is my favorite airplane. I've been collecting parts and pieces for it for a long time. Hoping to own one someday. You know how those dreams go. But, this guy came along and offered me something I couldn't turn down, so I could use those funds to go elsewhere and fix up some other projects and things. But we still got a lot of B-29 parts around here. Got the working center fire control turret system, and we got a tail turret, lots of components and things. But yeah, I still love the B-29. It was a pretty neat airplane.
Oh, absolutely. Well, if you're listening to us, folks, just a reminder, you're listening to Wix Warbird Weekly live, and you're listening to us live here on March 2nd. It's about 13 minutes after the hour, and we're speaking with Ty Ramey this evening from Vintage Aircraft in Stockton, California, and a longtime Wix member, and talking about his multiple Warbird experiences over the years. I have to ask something, you know, kind of diverging a little bit from B-29s. You talked about, you know, diverting some of your funds to new projects and that kind of thing. One specific project that has gotten a lot of people's interest in the last couple of months is really your kind of out of the blue resurrection of the PV2 Harpoon off of pretty much out of storage status at a little grass strip in the middle of central California and basically taking it into your care and bringing it back not only to flying condition but, you know, actively restoring the aircraft as well. How did that – I mean, a lot of us kind of jumped in halfway through, but how did that really all start? And you know, how has the journey been in your opinion so far at this point?
My interest in Harpoon started a long time ago. A buddy had a D-model Harpoon, Doug Lacey, who ended up crashing up in Clear Lake, California, a long time ago. Yeah, that was a real bad deal. I flew with him a bunch of that airplane. I always loved the Harpoon, and Doug's plane was really neat. He had all the equipment back inside, all the radios working, and it was just an awesome airplane. So I've always been interested in the Harpoon, and after he died, I ended up getting a bunch of his parts and pieces and manuals and information. So I've always had a soft spot for the Harpoon. And you know, I'd seen him around in various places, and I always thought it'd be neat to have one. Never really went after one. Any time I saw them for sale, they were usually too expensive. As this one was too, it was offered for sale for quite a while before we picked it up, and it was, again, just cost prohibitive to go after it at that kind of money. I've seen pictures of it. I hadn't visited the airplane in person, but then the land where it was this guy Ralph Johnson bought the plane. He had a bunch of other Harpoons too. Mm-hmm. He also had the B-29 Fertile Myrtle and a B-25 and a Mustang a long time ago, and he had a museum in Oakland. So he was kind of a big early Warbird guy. Mm-hmm. So he brought this Harpoon to his personal ranch up by Lake Berryessa in 1994. He bought a bunch of them, and all the others went elsewhere, and then this one went to his own personal ranch. And the story goes, he just kind of liked it there. It's sort of a conversation piece.
Yeah.
So it flew there in 94. These guys dropped it off, and nobody messed with it since. And then Ralph died, and then eventually his whole estate, all that land there, that big ranch, was sold. And the new owners had no interest in this, you know, cruddy old airplane sitting around, so they wanted it out. And then the lawyers got involved saying, yeah, okay, it needs to be out by this date, otherwise it's going to get cut up. And so then, you know, I talked to the people that owned it, and that's Everett's Air Fuel up in Alaska. They bought it years before with a bunch of other R2800s in the cans just for the engines to keep the C-46s running. But they brought the engines up there, and they never came down and got the airplane. So they're the ones that have been trying to sell it for a while. And then when I got a call from Chris Prevost and said, hey, you know, they're probably going to have to chop that thing up. You might want to check into it. So I called Marty up there at Everett's Air Fuel and asked them what the story was, and they said basically that they'd give the airplane to us if we had our 501c3 museum status set up, and give us like 6 months to do that. And we were already in the process of doing it, so we said, well, that would work, but let's go look at the airplane first and see what we're getting into. So we packed everything up in the beach, and we flew up there and taxied right up in front of it, and then got out and started looking at the plane, and you know what? It looked pretty good. And well, for most people, it looked really bad, but she was sunk down past her axles in the ground. The ground squirrels had been digging underneath it, and she was sitting on her belly tank, a big old a retardant tank. She was sitting square on that belly tank, and just, you know, weeds all around. And I wish there was grass up there at that strip, but it was dirt and sticker bushes.
Oh, yeah.
And, but I crawled inside, and you know, inside, it was amazing. She's, even though she's pretty stripped out, her original World War II paint is there, and then lots of little brackets and things that you don't see in harpoons were all still there. Normally, all the other harpoons I've seen, they get those things out like crazy, and there's just no, you know, World War II anything left inside. Well, this thing still had the bulkhead that is kind of rare right behind the pilot and co-pilot, and all these little brackets and things. It even had the shock mount for the flare gun was in it, and all sorts of stuff. And I thought, wow, she looked pretty good. And thinking, you know, this wouldn't be too hard to get her back to stock inside. But then the question is, how is she on the outside? So, you know, I looked around. I couldn't really find any corrosion. She really didn't look that bad. The engines, you know, the props turned. The engines are free. So it's like, all right, let's take this to the next step. So we went back, packed up tools, and then we flew back up there. And the thing was, if the engines were bad, then and we couldn't fly it out of there, then that's a whole other story. Man, we'd have to, you know, get a crane and take the fuselage off the wing center section. And oh my gosh, you know that then it would be real questionable.
And certainly, but, it wouldn't fit on your Beach 18 trailer that you've perfectly set up there.
You know, it probably would. I had thought about that, and there was a B-34 that was taken apart here, and I watched them pretty close, and yeah, you know, we could have hauled it out. We just got a new World War II record truck, you know, that would actually do the job, but, you know, again, it's just, it wasn't really going to be worth that kind of effort. So we went up to check on the engines, and we same thing, taxi that park in front of the beach, and then we pulled oil screens and see, hey, is there any metal in there or anything, and nope, they were clean. So that's a good sign. That means when she last came in, she was still doing all right. And started going through, you know, we got some fuel in the tanks and pumped that up to the carburetors, try and get the carb soaking and get the diaphragms, you know, soaking. That's one of the real soft spots in these things is those pressure carburetors and the diaphragms get dried. And so we want to get those soaking as soon as possible. And then eventually we started pulling the props through and doing started pre-oiling it and then pulling the props through by hand. And then after we did that, a bunch of blades, and we're real tired, then we decided, well, let's see if we can get the starter to go. And I think there's a video on YouTube of that, too. It's pretty funny. Ricky was standing there, and we had turned the engines over with the starter, and we forgot to check the mag switches, and they were still hot or on up in the cockpit. And while this thing is turning over, she woofed, like she tried to fire off. And said, holy cow.
Goody.
She's trying. You know, let's see if we can get her to run. Sure enough, we got the left engine fired up that day, the very first day we started working on it, and she didn't run good, too. So we had a boost pump problem on the right. We fixed that stuff the next day and got the right engine running, and the longer it was carb soaked, the better they ran, and it was pretty neat. So the engines were running. It's like, okay, we committed to going after this, and you know, she really didn't fight us very hard at all. You could tell that old girl, she really wanted to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, must have been an amazing environment for her to sit in, because other beach or other Lockies are sitting around, you know, like down at Shellville. I mean, the engines are kind of locked up, and corrosion is a big issue, but not on this old girl. She did really good.
You've got some amazing video of that little rescue that flight out of there. It just does your heart good to see an old airplane come back to life like that. And, you know, commend you for putting the video out there. It really shows some of what it takes out, you know, to do these kinds of things. And it kind of shares the thrill around. I really appreciate the video. It was really, really cool. So.
And I mean, for me, that was the first time I'd even seen or heard about the project. And so for me, I mean, being down here in Phoenix, I see all these old harpoons that are sitting around, literally scattered all over the place down here, and no one's been able to get one up in the air ever since the one was ferried to the Palm Springs Air Museum. So actually, kind of gave me hope that someday, you know, some of these airplanes out here might actually see air under the wings.
Yeah, one of they probably could.
One of the things I always, you know, get comments from guys that own them out here and you know, from folks that work on them and stuff is the wonderful Lockheed complexity. And of course you've been working on Beech-18s, which are relatively, from what I've, you know, gathered, are relatively nice airplanes to work with. What was the learning curve like as you kind of moved into the dreaded Lockheed territory? Did you ever have a time when everybody kind of was working on something and you just said, "What the hell are we doing this for?"
No, it was, you know, it's pretty straightforward. All the stuff in the Lockheed, it just kind of goes after some of the other stuff that we've been doing from, you know, I used to work on B-25 a long time ago. I claimed that I was one of the first employees that Aero Trader had when they were down in the desert. So I had some experience on B-25s, and we managed a B-25 for a guy for quite a while, and worked on some B-17s and all sorts of stuff. So, you know, we worked on the Big Iron for a while off and on, and you know, the Harpoon is just like pretty much all the others. You know, certain systems are pretty much, you know, a lot of common components from one plane to the next. Yeah, it's definitely a lot more complex than the Beech, but the systems that it has are just classic World War II systems that are real straightforward. Same on the R2800. I mean, you couldn't get a better engine. And I relied on the expertise of Ray Anderson. Ray used to have a shop here called Day Air at Stockton for a long time, and Ray is a good buddy, and man, he's a great guy. And he's an R2800 god. I mean, his dad used to build them too, and it's a lot of history there with Ray. Well, Ray got tired of the local political problems and airport management here, and he moved up to Idaho, and he's been happy ever since. And I called Ray to ask him his advice on the engine stuff, and he was very encouraging and very helpful. So that kind of stuff, I relied on him for specific 2800 information, and just in general, the stuff that we learned on all the other aircraft we've been working on just held true on this. It worked out real well, and we're fortunate that the plane was in really decent shape. You know, when the airplane was, the Harpoon was built in 1945, it was just after the war. It basically flew off to Litchfield Park, and when it was sold surplus in 1956, it had 7 hours of flight time on it. Wow. It was a brand new bird, and wow, right now she's got only 800 something hours on it. So she's still a pretty new airplane, and that's the one thing we see throughout the airframe is there's a lot of factory stuff and factory adjustments and things and original, you know, original factory, condition of the aircraft, which is pretty neat. I mean, we went through and checked everything and jacked it up too, did gear swings up there and all that stuff, and it's just in really nice shape. A lot of the other Harpoons were rode pretty darn hard, and this one wasn't. So it's,
wow,
it's another fortunate thing that was working in our favor as well.
But so how long was she?
Problems here and there, hydraulic leaks, and you know, fuel leaks, and all sorts of stuff that we have to go after and fix. But it's just a good plane to start with, anyway.
How long was she a tanker? I mean, that's a really low amount of hours for 60-year-old airplanes. So.
Yeah, it is, and she was a tanker. She was tanked up, I believe it was in 58, 59. And was a tanker ever since. And it turns out that she had some periods in there where she sat for a while, too. I talked to a guy who went to resurrect this Harpoon from Bill Dempsey's place in Kansas, and he said the same deal. It was almost sunk to its belly tank, and he had to resurrect it. But, you know, they got it out of Dempsey's place and flew it and tinkered on it just like we did, and then he found that she was a great, reliable airplane, too. And so I guess she had some periods where she just didn't fly that much. I almost think that, you know, they kind of kept her as the cream of the crop airplane because she was such low time compared to everything else. So she didn't see a lot of action. And you can see that on the airframe. I mean, there's not a lot of, you know, things that are all beat up wear-wise and everything else. She's, like I said, she's in pretty darn good shape. And no corrosion. That's the weirdest part is most all the Harpoons I've ever looked at, I mean, they've got big issues from corrosion, mostly from the retardant that's corrosive, and she had that pink color all over, you know, in places, but dang, she doesn't have any corrosion. When we finally dropped the tank out, up in the bomb bay and the spar area, we're going to see lots of things, but nothing. I mean, she's just, all you see are factory zinc and two spots of corrosion we found from like a rubber hose that had caused some intergranular where it touched something, but yeah, that's it. She's just in really good shape, so very fortunate.
Sounds like it's a testament to the Lockheed folks that built her as well, that, you know, the corrosion's not there. I mean, just an airplane sitting around can corrode. So if it's clean and well done, and I guess it was, the metals were right and the production was correct, and it sounds like she was treated well. That's good to hear. It's amazing.
Well, we've had like similar issues where we had a bunch of DC-3s or C-47s that we were working on with the Spunkmeyer airplanes, and one was the C-41 on the very first DC-3s, you know, that Hap Arnold owned, and then we had a 1945 C-47 B model, and it turns out that C-47B had massive intergranular corrosion, some of the stuff that you see on the North American products where they just had, you know, poor heat treating, and we had to change a ton of stringers on that plane, and we thought, well, geez, both planes are sitting out in Oakland in the same moist and salt air environment, that it had the same problems. So it looked at that, and it was absolutely, you know, fine, and that was a pre-war 1938 bird, so... You know, there is a lot of that, you know, the problems when they were cranking the planes out like crazy and had poor quality control or poor heat treat, which is showing up nowadays. Some of these stringers and things are blowing out. But not on this Lockheed. You know, she's in real good shape.
Well, I mean, they weren't really building them to last 60 years, you know, to be honest.
Sure. So, boy, there's that old adage, man. They don't build them like they used to.
Yeah.
And you walk down the wing of it, the wing on this thing, and it's just like you're walking on a sidewalk. It's built like a tank.
Wow.
And, that's what Bill Dempsey said. Dempsey's just, you know, old tanker guy from way back, old school. I mean, I think he had Connies and DC-4s and 6s and everything you could think of, and still does have a bunch of that stuff. And he's just as sharp as day one. And he said Lockheed built a hell of an airplane. He said, but dang, if they couldn't design a fuel system to save their lives. He said the Connie was even worse. He said that fuel system has killed more, you know, harpoons and killed a few pilots than most other airplanes just because they don't take the time to learn how the complex Lockheed fuel system worked. So, yeah, I definitely took that as a warning and learned it pretty good.
That's cool.
Well, yeah, it's beautifully.
Well, it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you. If you stick with us, Ty, would you mind, you know, sticking with us through the break? We got to take a quick break. We'd like to come back, and we got a couple of other questions, and because I mean, you've got just so much experience here, we want to get you while you're still on the radio. So we're going to take a quick 2-minute break for commercials, and we'll be right back with you here on Wix Warbird Weekly Live on March the 2nd. And again, we're speaking tonight with Ty Ramey from Vinge Aircraft in Stockton, California. And we'll be taking calls a little bit later on. 478-787-4768 is how you get a hold of us. We'll be right back with you, folks.
Live from Washington, D.C., this is Warbird Radio.
Log on now to FightingColors.com. That's FightingColors.com for more on Gary Velasco and his amazing nose art. That's FightingColors.com.
Hi, I'm Chris.
And I'm Rob.
And we're two of the crew members from Warbird Rescue. Call in Thursday nights at 8 Eastern to join the lively discussion of Warbird restoration. Find out how we can put you in touch with a Warbird project in your area. And be sure to visit us online at warbirdrescue.com.
That's warbirdrescue.com.
And we'll talk to you Thursdays at 8 right here on Warbird Radio.
Now showing on aerocinema.com.
1944. The English Channel is all that stands between a massive land invasion into Hitler's Europe. The Allies are poised and ready to make the crossing, and the Nazis are desperate to repel them. Using new technology and innovative concepts, the Luftwaffe will summon forth a dive bomber unique in looks and abilities. This will be their shield to defend against the flood of ships bound for German territory. A Pair of Hunchbacks, Part 1.
What a kick to be part of Warbird Radio with Big Man Jump, heard several times each week. I'm Don Kennedy, host of BBJ, inviting you to tune in, take off with Warbird Radio.
Live from the land of the free, because of the brave, this is Warbird Radio.
Welcome back to Wix Warbird Weekly Live, ladies and gentlemen.
Ah,
I know. It is Texas Independence Day, and we're celebrating here on Warbird Radio tonight. We're talking with Warbird restoration expert and active Wix member Ty Ramey. And for those of you who have been listening to this great conversation this evening, we encourage you to check out the ongoing thread named PV2D Harpoon 84062. Tanker 101 comes back to life. It seems to always be on the front page of Wix somehow, so we encourage you to go over there, check it out again at warbirdinformationexchange.org to get a little bit of information about what we're talking about this evening. And we've been discussing that exact restoration and bringing that aircraft back to life. So we're glad to have you again with us here tonight, Ty. One question I had is you had mentioned that you've been so active in keeping, you know, turrets alive and stuff, and we'll be getting a little bit later on to another area that I know that you've been very active with, which is the Collings Foundation's bomber camp. But do you have the turrets and the armament pretty much, you know, ready to go with the PV2 when the time comes to put it on board, or is that a process that you're still working on?
Yeah, we sure do. Well, we're collecting stuff all the time, but we do have a Martin turret ready to go in. It's a new old stock turret. Needs some cleaning up, but it's kind of thing is fully operational. A couple things we need to come up with to install it. I got to make an adapter ring for it that was kind of peculiar to the PV1 and PV2. It should look straightforward. I think we can make that. And then got to get a turret fairing back from Carl Scholl on to him a while ago, and I got a dome for it. So yeah, the turret's gonna. Once we get that adapter ring made, we should be able to get the turret back in pretty easy. We've got rocket rails all set. We're desperately trying to find the pylons that went on the wings for the drop tanks. They even had gun pods that could drop bombs off those pylons. It's kind of baffling to me. Those pylons were used on P-38s, P-61s, PV-1s, PV-2s. It's all the same basic Lockheed design pylon. And yet we can't find them anywhere. It's just bizarre. I don't quite understand that. You think being used on so many airplanes that you'd be able to find them out there, but so far no luck. So if anybody knows of any wing pylons for those aircraft, we sure appreciate any parts and pieces or whole entire pylons. That'd be wonderful. The Harpoon, the PV-1 and PV-2 are kind of classic looking of those big drop tanks hanging on the wings, and that's one thing we sure like to recreate. So,
Absolutely. I mean, and the other quick question I had in regards to this, you kind of had a public moment this past month with the ability to fly it down to San Diego and take part in the Centennial of Naval Aviation activities down there. How was that? I mean, was it kind of a surprise to a lot of people to see the aircraft down there? And was the reception pretty warm seeing an aircraft like this that really has been just resurrected from the bushes, you could say?
Yeah, we had a really good, a lot of interest in the airplane. She like I mentioned on the thread, that she wasn't the prettiest belle at the ball, but motto is you should have seen her before we started. So she was bare metal. We painted a star and bar on her just before we went, so she looked kind of like a warbird. But it was warmly received. It was pretty neat. We had big photos blown up of what she looked like when we got her and the first flight home and all that. So there was a lot of interest. And we got a lot of donations, too. I mean, people, bought shirts and stickers and donated. We got about $300-$400 down there, which was really pretty cool. We met three PV2 vets and heard some great stories from these guys, and that's kind of what it's all about, is these guys, and it's just amazing to listen to their stories. So that was the neatest thing. And the Navy was wonderful to us. We contracted for a certain amount of gas, and when everybody got down there, it's like, take all the gas you want, we'll top you off no matter what. That was pretty cool.
That's great.
We had a wonderful show. I mean, great turnout, great crowds, beautiful aircraft, all those retro paint schemes were just the neatest thing to see.
Oh, yeah.
It was really neat. It was a real hard push to get her there. There were so many hurdles to get over to make that happen, from just getting a type rating in the airplane, get the check ride done, and getting the plane ready for the check ride. And we'd hope to do a bunch of flight training before that check ride. Well, that didn't happen. We had 50 minutes right before the examiner got there to go out in the morning and ring out the harpoon and shut down the, you know, each engine and go through all the stall series and everything else on a plane that I've never done that before. So then we went to the check ride, and that went well. And it was blowing 25 to 35, you know, miles an hour, about 90-degree crosswind that day. So that was fun. I like a good challenging crosswind. Not normally on a check ride, but it was really cool. That old bird, she's really fun to fly. So that was fun. And then, yeah, we did the check ride. That was on a Tuesday. And then we continued working on her, getting everything squared away. Could start painting on her Wednesday, Thursday, and got her all packed up. And turns out by the time we're ready to go on Wednesday, we were going to get there just after dark. So we decided to go Friday morning. Mm-hmm. And went down Friday, and it was a great show. It was really neat. So we wanted to have been a part of that.
So you, I know you posted on the forum that it was that star was freshly painted, and you weren't kidding there, huh?
Yeah, it didn't fly off. One of my mechanics, Cade, he's our painting guy, and then he was really reluctant about painting the star on there, and we were trying real hard, and I think the biggest concern he had was just laying it out and not getting it right and making it look kind of, you know, dorky. But I said, hey, Cade, no problem. You know, I'll lay the thing out. All you got to do is take the lines. And they said, okay, cool. And so we got the blueprints out, found the exact dimensions of the one for the harpoon, and we're able to mask it out, and it turned out pretty good. And then Cade shot it. You know, it's quick and dirty, and it's going to come off before we paint it, of course. But, hey, like I said, should have seen it before we started.
Yeah, that's true. Really.
And for those of you... go ahead. I was looking through the entire the entire story of the thing coming back to life, I had to have a chuckle. Because I'm wondering how many people actually noticed and commented on how nice your tail cone looked compared to what you had before. that was a unique piece of work on what it had up there before, and certainly was a field modification to say the least.
Oh yeah, wasn't that beautiful?
Yeah. That's some quality sheet metal work.
You know, there's some dents and dings here and there on the airplane, you know, but that was one of those really big ones that, okay, we really need to, you know, that's pretty darn visible. We need to fix this one. And thankfully, Carl Scholl had an extra tail cone down at his place, and it had a bunch of corrosion issues on it, but we were able to fix that and make it work. So, yeah, that was quite the patch job that somebody did there back in his day.
Yeah, that was... Kept the birds out, though, right? So,
yeah. Yeah, marginally.
Yeah, I was going to say. Little gnats and mud daubers and stuff. Getting those little nooks and crannies from those big, big holes and wrinkles inside of it and such. So, again, folks, if you get a chance, take a look at the forum and take a look at the post, and you'll have the chuckle along with us here. So,
Zane,
I'm sorry I cut you off before you had a question.
Oh, yeah, no problem. I was just going to we could switch gears a little bit here, Ty, of what – have you got plans for the Collings Foundation? I know you do the Bomber Fantasy Camp, Bomber Crew Fantasy Camp, and I was wondering if you guys got that on the schedule planned again this year? And, you know, kind of tell us what that's all about and how that works.
Yeah, Bomber Camp's a pretty neat deal. I got involved with the Collings Foundation, and Rob Collings is sure a cool guy, and he's just really neat. They got a great operation, a lot of neat people out there. It was just a lot of fun. So after I kind of got involved with them a little bit, I was helping them find radios and things for their A36 and working with Gary down there, American Aero Services, and Rob, you know, gave me the invitation to come on out and join them, and geez, what an honor to be able to hop in the seat of the bombers. And I had been tight to the B-25, so I was able to fly their B-25 on the tour, and then they let me start sitting in the right seat of the 24 and the 17 and, scare those guys. So that was pretty fun. And, you know, as I got to know them a little bit more, I was like, hey, Rob, how about we, you know, go drop some bombs or shoot some zens out of this thing? But, all right, that sounds like fun. And so we set up a kind of test trial where we rigged up our dummy bombs and had the 50 calibers going, and we got World War II B-24 B-17 gunners back up to shoot the 50s, you know, with the full auto blanks, in the waist, and it was neat to see these guys shooting the guns again. They just had a blast, and we went and tried the Norden Bombsight down at using an Eagle Field. One of the Wicks members, Ryan Davis, RWD Fresno, one of the co-owners of Eagle Field, an old World War II training base, which is a really neat place. They were kind enough to let us use Eagle Field, which is kind of in the middle of nowhere, for doing our bomb drop. And you know, it's the first time we've been dropping bombs out of the B-25s before and other aircraft at low level, just kind of by eye. And this is the first time we actually got the Norden running. And we had the bomb rack set up so we could drop through the Norden. And on this whole trial period, I'm up in the nose. You don't get very many opportunities to drop bombs with the Norden. And so I didn't have much practice. And we did some dry runs and practice synchronizing with the Norden we got here in our museum. And seemed to be working pretty good. So we tried a live run. And dang, so I didn't get pretty darn close to the target. I had asked Joe Davis, owner of Eagle Field, if he could put one of your old dead trucks out there to use as a target so I can see it from altitude. Mm-hmm. And he did. I even sent down my own video camera to put right next to or on the truck itself, because I figured the safest place to be in that whole area was that truck, the thing I'm aiming at.
Yeah.
And sure enough, you can see in the video later that the bombs came in. They landed about, I think one was, what I'm thinking, 70 feet short or something like that. There's a whole string, and we dropped a salvo of, I think it was five bombs, and it was pretty cool video, those things coming in and hitting the ground. And the sound they made was just amazing. So it was really cool. Then later when I saw the video shot from my camera, it's like, oh my gosh, Joe put a World War II ton and a half Chevy truck out there, for us to drop bombs on. I'm like, Joe, oh my God, I worship these trucks. But going back to, hey, the safest place to have been was sitting inside that truck that day. That was our little test trial, and after that, it's like, well, let's try and make a full bomber camp out of this. And we got all the equipment, all that kind of stuff, and the knowledge up at our shop and our museum to do this kind of stuff. We've been doing it for a while. Did a couple other PBS shows and other things where we're dropping bombs on the B-25s, and it's like, well, if we can turn this into a camp where we can get people to come in and raise some money for the Collins Foundation, and it worked. We had basically two crews of six each come in for a two-day course, and we teach them navigation and radio equipment and gunnery and bombing equipment in the ground school in the morning on the first day. And then after lunch, we head out to the gunnery range, and like last year, everybody got to shoot the .45, the Luger, the carbine, Garand, Springfield, working up to a handheld shotgun, and in the shotgun we'd have the skeet, or shooting skeet with the handheld shotgun, and then you'd progress up to the turret truck. We built this ton and a half Chevy truck, replica of the turret training truck they used, and put a powered Crocker Wheeler turret in there with a shotgun up in the turret, just like they did training with, and tried to get the skeet from the turret truck, and it's a blast. I put up $20.
That sounds like so much fun.
Yeah, to the first person that actually hit the skeet from the turret truck, and somebody did it. It was pretty neat. and then from that, then you progress to the 50 caliber. So we have a 50 caliber on the range. It's a semi-auto gun, and you start shooting the big 50 from the Modus, which is darn impressive. It's like a little artillery piece. And so it's a great deal. The neatest thing about this is there's a World War II reenactment group. Living history folks from Arizona that recreate the ground crew stuff, and they are just an instrumental part of this whole camp, because they bring an air of authenticity to this that's just amazing. And they're all, they live in the hangar in cots out of their footlockers and talk the talk and walk the walk, and it's just the neatest thing. So they really bring this, put an awesome touch to the bomber camp. So that's the end of the first day. We have a dinner too, and then we come back, and then day two is basically doing the individual training and going through the aircraft, learning the different crew positions in the B-24. And those who volunteer to try the ball turret out, we've got our own ball turret, and we actually do the training on the ground in that ball turret prior to the one in flight. So turrets are, they're manual machines that you got to be real careful with, so you need to respect them and learn how to operate them safely. And and then we bring everybody through the aircraft and get ready and start doing the bomb loading drill and get the bombs all set up, and then we go fly a mission. So one of the crews goes up on the mission. The other crew usually goes out to the bombing range to watch the bombs drop, and we go and we do a bunch of runs and drop individually. We'll usually bring four bombs, drop two on individuals, and then drop a salvo at two. And it's fairly low level, and these the bomb site people change the crew positions, and you can even shoot. There's a full auto 50 in the way shooting blanks, and usually in the past we've had the Collings Mustangs been around doing little fighter curves, and we've been hoping the last couple of years to get the 262 up online, which is going to be the ultimate. So We're hoping it'll be ready this year. And, have the 262 zooming around and trying to shoot at that with the 50s in the waist. It's just an amazing experience. It's a lot of fun. And the campers have a great time, and several of them keep coming back every year. They like it so much. And we're doing the same this year. It's going to be first week of June, I think it is. I think that's when it is, June. I can't even see the calendar from here, but check it with our website or check out the Collings Foundation website, and they'll give you the information on it. But it's just a blast. It's really fun.
Oh yeah, and it's looks like it's going to be over. Let's see, I have the website up here. If you go to cfdn.org, you'll get more information about that. But if you want to see some fantastic photos from the from Bomber Fantasy Camp, go to Ty's website at twinbeach.com. That's T-W-I-N, and then B-E-E-C-H.com, and you'll see the link there. And there's videos, there's photos of it, and lots of stuff. And actually, that's a little bit of a segue that I probably ought to speak to your business that you actually have. You've become kind of the Beach 18 restoration expert, starting from those early days back at San Jose State all the way till now. If you would enlighten us a little bit about what you guys do out there, and how you're keeping the Beach 18, the C-45 line, and the AT-11 line alive in your business, and if anybody's interested in possibly getting into a reasonable warbird these days, which would be the C-45 or the AT-11, what can you guys do to maybe help a person along in the process?
Yeah, the Beach 18 is an awesome airplane, and I'm kind of partial to the military variants, but they made that airplane from the late 30s all the way through the late 60s, and all different versions you could think of, and they had a great military career, especially during World War II. I think all the Beach 18s used in World War II were really what set Beechcraft and got them going. The Beech during the war was used as just a multi-engine trainer, instrument trainer, radar trainer, navigation, bombardier, gunnery, just everything you could think of, aerial photography. So we used them like mad and made a bunch of them. And the AT-11 is, of course, my favorite airplane just because it's a miniature bomber. The gun turret on it and the glass nose and 1,000-pound bombs and handheld 30-caliber machine gun, Norden bomb sight, same C-1 autopilot that the B-17 used. So that's a really neat little plane. And 90% of all the bombardiers trained in these during the war. So that's my favorite. And it's one of the most sought-after ex-military Twin Beaches around. When I got that AT-11 and started looking for another one, found another one, got it flying, and I ended up bringing that to an air show thinking, hey, maybe I can try and sell rides in the airplane. And so I put out a sign, and lo and behold, it was very successful. I had a lot of people going flying with us and that OS MB1, that kind of started its own little business. I was flight instructing at the time and started doing rides at air shows, and, man, this worked out really well. The neatest thing was everybody had a blast. It was a real positive, fun experience. And so I ended up selling that airplane, that flying airplane, and then buying two other Hulks from Team Air Museum that were sitting out back then in that place, and just kind of started the business. And that grew into doing maintenance on Beach 18s and then restoration work and doing flight instruction and continuing to do the rides and just doing pretty much anything. Beach 18 built a special trailer for hauling them on the ground. And there are pretty much three Beach 18 shops in around the country, and one's in Texas and one's up in Wisconsin, and we're the only one this side of Texas. So we get customers coming from all over the place, even our international business has picked up. With all the downturn with the economy, our domestic business has, dropped off a bit like everybody else's, but we've picked up a bunch of foreign customers too, which has been pretty nice.
Mm-hmm. You guys are doing some pretty important stuff with the preservation of these airplanes. I mean, with the spar concerns on the BJ-18, stuff there. You guys, I guess, have developed this spar strap kit and that kind of thing. I mean, you guys do full up from just annuals to complete rebuilds of these airplanes, right?
Yeah, we sure do. For ourselves, we've taken some derelict airplanes, like the one out of the back lot of Pima Air Museum or the one back in Saginaw, Michigan, and take the old derelict plane, just like the Harpoon, and resurrect them. To me, that's the most fun, is taking a plane that's just about to go off to the scrapyard and then breathing life back into them and watching them come back up. So to me, that's the most fun, the most rewarding, the most satisfying part. We got customers that come from all over the place to bring the aircraft to us for annuals and inspections and modification work and restoration. And there's 5 EJ-18s in the shop right here and probably another 6 or so outside. Some are our own, but mostly are in the customer's planes that we're fixing up and taking care of. We have, there's 3 AT-11s in the shop. One is actually my own stock original plane that I never seem to get to work on. another AT-11 is a customer's plane. Then we got Canadian Beach in here that gentleman wants it to be all stock and original. So, it's one thing I wish we'd found more of, our customers that want them completely original and authentic. That's really what turns me on, what I really like to do. Mostly the guys want to customize the BJ-18s to their specific needs and make them look like a warbird on the outside and yet, comfortable for mom and the kids on the inside. And the beach is great for that. I mean, we get a lot of people trading in T-28s or T-6s for the beach because they can haul away from the kids comfortably. And you get up, walk around, and there's a bathroom in the back if you want, and they're really a neat airplane for that. Great air show, and also great for, CAF units or small groups to bring everybody up to the shows, and relatively economical as warbirds go, so...
And you still can find there's still a pretty good amount of parts supplies that are out there because of the fact that they were used, as corporate airplanes back, after the war. And, obviously Beach had support with the airplanes well into the 50s. You find that there are specific versions that you're not able to find parts and pieces as easily for.
Yeah, it's just like any other warbird. The stuff that's hard to find is the stuff that gets used up, and that's, brakes and certain wear components. But yeah, we've been very fortunate to find parts. We've been kind of buying stashes of parts and inventories from companies. Kind of as the old companies go away, we stepped in and bought inventories. We bought Sam Goldman, Chesapeake Airways had a whole bunch of a huge stash of BJ-18 parts, and that went to a nice gentleman in Colorado who we bought from, them from him. Aerospace Products was a company, a big BJ-18 company, one of the biggest, and they're the ones that invented that spar strap kit, the aerospace strap kit that I ended up purchasing from them. And then we ended up buying their whole inventory of parts and technical information and just been collecting as much as possible. So we've got, 4 hangers full of stuff, and wow, we are slowly going through everything and getting an inventory. And it's just agonizingly slow, but we're, one of the biggest parts outfits around. There was the biggest parts outfit was a guy back in Owosso, Oklahoma, Dave Warren, wonderful man, and sadly he died, and we were kind of hoping to be able to buy their place, but it's just a little bit more than we can afford, but a great lot, stash of parts back there, just beautiful stuff. And so Dave was always the number one guy to go to for beach parts, and we still get parts from them, but it's kind of tough. The family still gets to parts when they can. So that was a big part source that has kind of been reduced. But in general, they made so much during World War II and after the war, there's a lot of that stuff out there. The stuff that is hard to find is the restoration items, finding original seats. Everybody wants the beach reclining seats, and they're getting hard to find. But the things I see are like the AT-11s, it's hard to find bomb doors. It's hard to find bomb sight mounts, the gun turret stuff, that kind of thing. But that's normal. It's pretty much any warbird. It's all that stuff that got thrown away years ago. Same with the Harpoon, we're lucky to find bomb doors for that. But it's Some of that stuff's hard to come by, and then other things are a little bit more expensive. But in general, I mean, if you compare it to any other aircraft out there, then parts are still pretty darn cheap. You know, overhaul for an engine is around $35,000, which seems like a lot, but I mean, you probably pay that much for your, you know, Cessna engine or something nowadays. So it's still pretty good. I think it's pretty economical. And then right now, you can sure buy a lot of Beech 18 for not much money.
That's true. Well, I really appreciate it. I mean, it's been absolutely wonderful talking with you, Ty. I wish we could continue on, but you know, we're going to have to wrap up the show here, and maybe we'll have you, if you want to come back, we would love to have you back on again. Maybe do a, you know, a Beech 18 show completely on that note. So, but it's been a real honor, and heck, you've made the show easy for us tonight. So, thank you very much again for joining us this evening.
Yeah, you happen. Hope it didn't bore you too bad, but I'd be glad to, anytime. Or come on out and do a live broadcast from Bombacam. That'd be kind of fun.
That would be fun.
Oh, yeah, that would be great.
Yeah. give me a chance to be in the turret trainer. I'll be happy.
Sounds good. Come on out.
Well,
thanks,
folks.
Ty.
All right.
Thank you very much, Ty. Well, folks, again, our guest tonight was Ty Ramey here on the Wix Warbird Weekly Live on March 2nd, and we thank you very much for listening in to this evening, and if you want to join us again next week, same time, Wednesdays, 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, and if you'd like to visit the website for more information, go to www.twinbeech.com for more information about Ty Ramey's vintage aircraft in Stockton, California. Thanks a lot, folks. Have a great night.